what I'd like to do in dealing with this topic is not just to dive right into the controversial and very well-known kinds of attacks and criticisms made of the World Council, but just to run a very quick sketch before you of how some of these issues came to be dealt with historically, so you have some idea that it's not just a recent development in the ecumenical movement that has led to what some people would even call a backlash, which I don't think is true. And all the while keeping in mind that, which I needn't read, we may come back to it, but the basic purpose of the World Council of Churches, I believe, is still representing its mandate, probably more so now than ever before in the history of the World Council. Those underlying words have become central and basic to what the World Council of Churches is doing. But just by way of an historical sketch, and then to move into just a very brief catalog of the kinds of criticisms that have been raised of the World Council and the kinds of responses given. And then I'd just like to open it up and see what kinds of feelings and advice and counsel we have among us here in dealing with this aspect of the ecumenical movement. Some dates to hook some of this onto would be the following. 1920 was the time when the ecumenical patriarch in what is now Istanbul came out with a statement which really urged the formation of a kind of league of churches comparable to the League of Nations, and that was in the air, of course, those early decades of the century. And that triggered a lot of thought about the formation of a kind of world council of churches dating way back to 1920 with Orthodox impetus, which is interesting. So it wasn't until 1961 in New Delhi that the Orthodox came in full force, heavy force. But they were involved from the very beginning and very influential. Also, 1925, a key meeting, a life and work consultation took place in Stockholm. And at that meeting, a very clear statement about the importance of dealing with and wrestling with the question of racism was developed, which is to indicate this is not a new innovation in the history of the ecumenical movement. But as early as 25, it was on paper and was part of a movement, life and work movement, which later merged with Faith and Order in 1948 to form the World Council. So that was an early issue, and a commitment to dealing with it and even combating racism was on paper and discussed at length as early as that. 1938, a group actually made concrete plans for the formation of the World Council, and then the Second World War intervened. And it was 10 years later, 1948, that the Council actually took shape and was formed. But it's important to note that that Second World War influenced the thinking about the formation of the World Council. At one meeting in 1948, right prior to the Amsterdam Assembly, there was a preparatory gathering that took place. And Bishop Berggrav from Norway, as you know, a leader in the resistance movement in Norway during the Second World War, was one of the leaders at that gathering. You know, there's a very tense moment in the meeting because the German bishops appeared, some of them having been a part of the confessing church movement in Germany, Niemöller and others. And people were then wondering how the resistance kinds of leadership of the churches, say in Norway, and even the churches of Norway, would be able to relate to the brothers and sisters from Germany. And at a very dramatic moment, the room went silent in that instance, and Bishop Berggrav and the bishop from Germany simply said nothing to each other but embraced, and then sat down in their chairs in the meeting, then noticeably relaxed, and could begin with the concrete task of trying to set the stage for the formation of the World Council. So I mention this to indicate that the political allegiances and our ideological allegiances have played an important role all through the history of the ecumenical movement, and sometimes have been obstacles, sometimes have not been obstacles when people have learned to transcend them. That's one thing we could come to after a bit. Also in 1948, it's no accident that capitalism and communism, two global kinds of ideologies, were basic to the discussion at Amsterdam. And Dulles and Hromadka debated the issues as two examples of positions on either side of that ideological wall. There were, incidentally, at that meeting, 147 member churches in 1948. And as you know, there are now over 300 in the World Council. Most of those churches came from the North Atlantic world, which should be noted. That now is nearly reversed, which also indicates something of why the profile of the World Council has changed, the issues are dealt with in a different fashion, You simply have a reverse of the balance of power, if you want to talk in that language, within the life of the World Council. 1954 was a very calm kind of assembly in North America. In Amsterdam, they said, "We intend to stay together," at the close of the meeting. Powerful statement in light of the possibility that the whole thing could have blown apart at the very first assembly. But the statement that we intend to stay together is one that's repeated over and over again at ecumenical meetings, particularly when things get difficult and it looks as though things may not move in a positive direction, and there may even be a disintegration rather than an integration of it. The New Delhi meeting was a key one for our purposes tonight, and that would be simply for the reason that it took place in Asia, and also because of the massive influx of official representatives of the churches of the Orthodox East. My own estimate is that in the Soviet Union, rather than 30 million of people, many of us are convinced that there is upwards of 70 to 100 million of worshiping active Christians in the Soviet Union. Because I've done some work with that and been often involved in the life of that church over the last 7-8 years. On Thursday night, if anybody's interested, I think we're scheduling one little hour for anybody who wants to just talk specifically about the Russian church and its role in the ecumenical movement. But the presence of the Russians and the Bulgarians and the Romanians and the North African Orthodox and the people from Finland who are Orthodox made a phenomenal difference in the life of the World Council, because prior to that time it had been primarily North Atlantic, white, and Protestant. But at that time there was a clear shift in the membership and the representation. And the Orthodox simply don't think as most of us in the West think about most basic issues. And they're a very visible entity in every meeting, and certainly the films even of the assembly. If you'd spot it today, when John showed the film of the plenary, there was a large block in the middle of the right side of the plenary with black-robed folks, and they were metropolitans and bishops and nuns from the Soviet Union, in a large representation. Soviet Union has over 30, I think, doesn't it now? So we're talking about a very significant presence in the ecumenical movement, a very difficult one. And it raises the East-West ideological question by their mere presence. Most of those churches are in a socialist or Marxist ideologically oriented country. 68, my own interpretation is that it took the World Council 20 years to really find a centered approach to its work, and that occurred in 1968 when it happened that they could take very strong stands on the issues of the day. And it was a heated decade, if any of you happened to have been teaching in those years, as some of us were. The racism issue was the black power issue, the combating of racism, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in the United States, right prior to that World Assembly at which he was to have spoken. You had the anti-war movement going. You had also the rising concern about multinational corporations, even though that didn't come up very clearly until a decade later, as you mentioned in another setting. But it was beginning to be talked about there, a flurry of explosive issues that had to be dealt with. And that was the time when the program to combat racism began to be shaped. Actually started in 1970, all right, two years after the Uppsala Assembly. But some of the leaders involved there, such as Rena Karifa Smart, who teaches at Howard Divinity School in Washington, was involved in those heated discussions at Uppsala, which finally brought about a shift in the approach of the World Council from merely condemning racism to saying, no, we must back our words up with concrete action. And the motivation was there to do it in 68. Also, there were concerns about medical and health issues, and shortly after that, the Christian Medical Commission got formed. So that was a period when a lot of very concrete actions involving controversial issues were taken. 75, my impression at Nairobi was, and John could verify this, was that there was a feeling in Nairobi we didn't want to stir the soup too much after Uppsala, sort of keep the debate under control, not run the risk that was run in Uppsala of a repeat of that. My own impression was it was kind of a custodial assembly in 75. And well, tonight later we're going to get to impressions of people who were at Vancouver, so we won't have to talk about that much. But now regarding the opposition that has surfaced all along the way to this World Council of Churches, which I think we should remember also is not the ecumenical movement, but probably the most comprehensive expression of the ecumenical movement that exists. And certainly the most important and most universal forum, I think, that has existed even in the history of the church now, with Roman Catholic Church involvement increasing in some ways, even though they're not full members. But the ecumenical movement is more basic and broader than that, and there are other expressions of it, whether you're talking about the YWCA, the YMCA, or the bilateral dialogues among world communions, or these other kinds of things. So opposition to the World Council sometimes also is opposition against the whole ecumenical movement. Sometimes it's specifically targeted at the World Council. I got on an airplane leaving Vancouver the other day, and I didn't need this at all, but I sat down by a gentleman who asked me where I was coming from. I said the World Assembly, and I had very few words after that, very few little opportunity to say anything for an hour and a half. Canadian gentleman who kept saying, "You people," meaning you World Council people, "have no right to try to make the rest of us feel guilty, the rest of us Christians. What you should do is get out of politics, quit messing around in politics, and get right with God." One constant recurring theme was get right with God as an individual and leave the political, you know, other concerns that you're all getting messed up with and involved with alone. You should not be doing that as Christians. And an hour and a half of a critique, I said very little, didn't want to, given the state of mind he was in. But he had sort of absorbed every major critique of the World Council of Churches, and I asked him if he'd been out to worship with us. He was a Vancouver resident. He said no, he hadn't done that, because all he needed to learn was what he learned from the newspapers. He saw we were ready to condemn capitalism, and we're very soft on communism. So all of these things that the newspapers somehow had communicated to him. Now, another individual at Vancouver, a press representative from St. Louis, was asked what he was covering there. And he said, "Well, I'm waiting to see what kinds of controversial and important newsworthy items are coming up at the assembly." And he was asked if he had gone to any of the worship services and what's going on in the tent and observed any of that phenomenal, you know, significant activity. And he said, "No, I'm not bothered with it at all, because I see it entirely as a sideshow and a camouflage that the World Council is setting up in order to confuse people, in order to free them to go at their real purpose and to pursue the real intent of this assembly." Now, that was the kind, we had some of those kinds of press people there. So in case you read articles written by folks like that, you can see very often you miss the fundamental churchly character of the ecumenical endeavor and pick up those items which make the World Council look like another political action committee working in Washington, D.C. as a lobby community or something. So you ask yourself, what kind of fears are involved there? And I would spot about five of them, and then I'll go to some specific critiques and we'll just open this up. I think that the opposition to and criticism of the World Council has always been there from the beginning of the modern ecumenical movement, which would date from about 1910, the beginning of the structured efforts to bring the churches back together in the early part of the century. One of those underlying fears, I think, is simply the fear of loss of our identity. In one instance, a specific kind of identity would be the fear of loss of national identity. Some people feared the formation of the League of Nations for that reason. We are Irish, or we are Dutch, or Swedish, and what's going to happen when we start really talking about a world government? The same thinking is present when you talk to some Reformed, or Episcopal, or Lutheran, or Orthodox, or whoever you might be talking to as individuals. Say, we really don't want to risk losing what is so dear to us in our tradition, and or our nation, and recognizing it most parts of the world don't have the relationship to the governments that we have here in Canada and the United States. When a shingle blows off the roof in Copenhagen, it's a government official who decides whether to replace that tile, in this case, rather than shingle. It's not a church official. So when you have that kind of close marriage of Landeskirchen in Germany or state churches in Denmark, Sweden, Finland, or wherever, you have a whole different kind of arrangement when you're talking about social political issues and church issues as they relate to them. The second fear would be, I think, a fear expressed by clergy, and it has to do with power. We notice in the advances made in the ecumenical movement having to do with unity in one faith. A key document there you've heard about is the famous Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry text, which was finally put together and positively affirmed in January of 1982, on the basis of which our liturgy was worked out. In that text on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry, it's very clear when you come to the last of those three concerns on ministry. And this would be true in dialogue between Lutherans and Catholics, for example, and dozens of other efforts at dialogue. You come to the question of power. What's the nature of the office of the ministry? How does the office of the bishop work in our churches? Who makes decisions for whom? And you're dealing with very delicate matters in which people have huge personal investments in church leadership. And that issue is not going to go away. Philip Potter, in his introductory address report really in Vancouver, hooked four very explosive words together at one point. And I think he did it purposely. We could argue about that. But he said we must exercise the authority or the abused, right? The abuse of the authoritative positions of the magisterium, something like that. Use power.
Heresy
of the magisterium. Even stronger words. Exercise the heresy of the magisterium.
Magisterial hierarchy.
Magisterial hierarchy. That was in there too.
Authority.
So you had authority, exorcism, hierarchy.
Exercise the heresy of magisterial authority.
Magisterial authority. Imagine four explosive words.
And not allow them to impose. Yeah. This impose everybody forgot. Yeah.
So what's involved there when he did that, I just came to mind now, but remembering those kinds of words laid out by a general secretary indicate that he too, in his last years of his work as general secretary, is very concerned about this question, not just in one church, but really in all churches, how that works and what influence it has on our lay ministries or our ministry as ordained folks. A third thing, of course, would have that I've mixed up with the first, and it is a religious identity, not just a political identity. There is certainly communities in the world who would be anti-ecumenical purely on the grounds of the belief that they possess the one and true interpretation of the gospel. And anything else is a dilution of that or selling away of essential understandings of the faith and so on. A fourth would be fear of a global witness of Christians. That is, simply fear that the Christian communities around the world really might join hands one with the other and act on some important issues. I know in Washington, we could get into some of the developments there that relate to anti-ecumenical work in North America, and they're very dramatic and disturbing to some of us. If you touch some of those, you could see that behind a lot of the generation of criticism of the ecumenical effort is simply the fear that there's a different kind of political alliance and configuration emerging, and that will follow up the the work of those who really have power in terms of determining policy nationally or internationally, at least for our own government in the United States. And lastly, the fear of dealing with personal and collective ethical responsibility. A lot of people are very comfortable working with their personal ethical responsibility, as was the fellow sitting by me in the plane, who told me many of his virtues, lots of his virtues. But when we talked about the fact that he was an executive of a multinational corporation, and I asked, where, in what countries do you work, and how much of the income is staying there, how much of the profit is staying in that country, what's happening to the raw materials, those things he did not want to touch, and he didn't want the church touching those questions. So we do have a fear of relating both the individual and the collective ethical responsibility. Now I'm going to proceed with great caution, and I'm just going to take some samples here, because the danger always in talking about concrete criticisms of the World Council is that it saps energy. And I was happy to see in Vancouver, even though we had placard-carrying people there, and even some guerrilla street theater-type activity going on with KGB people, whipping other folks, both in black robes, convincing them to get engaged in the Western peace movement. So, with that kind of strange critique on the streets, you still found very little public or serious acknowledgement. Most of us collected the anti-ecumenical documentation for files on that subject. You know, and you can see the pattern of the kinds of critiques. But it didn't affect the functioning of the assembly, I think, even though McIntyre and the usual voices were there. But let me just pick some simply stated criticisms of World Council with a one or two sentence response. And I'll pick four or five of them and then stop, and we'll just open it up for the remainder of the period. One common criticism is this question: is the World Council of Churches Marxist-oriented? The answer, when an effort has been made to answer that publicly, is simply to say clearly that it is not. But it has a concern for the world's poor and the world's oppressed, and that is a concern for humanity, which also the Marxists say they're concerned about, and other people of some other ideological stripes would also say they're concerned about the oppressed. So there is that association immediately. But the World Council has never wanted to relinquish its mandate to speak out on questions of poverty and oppression out of fear of being associated with others who may be talking the same kinds of language. Another question is, does the World Council of Churches support violence? The answer, of course, it does not. But at the same time, it would say that it has given moral support to racially oppressed people, and some of them have been involved in liberation movements and struggles in which there had been violence on both sides. And the World Council openly says that. And it has said that it is not going to pass judgment, in quotes, on those victims of racism who are driven to violence. But it has given funds only for food, medicine, education, shelter for families and refugees on both sides of the struggles. In the case where the World Council was most severely criticized in 78 with the grant of $85,000 to the Liberation Front in what was then Rhodesia, they did also give money to the guerrilla negotiators in order to come up to Britain and begin to negotiate peace. And that story is not so often told. I think money came from France, Switzerland, a number of countries. And that was a very fruitful negotiation process that went on there. And the World Council also supported that. To jump down to a different one, how did the church get involved with liberation movements? One often talked about. I suppose historically you'd have to say that except for pacifist groups, the church has supported causes that it deemed to be just, even though there was to be violence involved, including both vocal and active support for the American Revolution, incidentally, if you want to look at it historically. So the British yoke of oppression was thrown off by very irregular troops, if you remember, and the church was involved in that. So historically, I think you'd have to keep that in mind when we are talking about what now seems to be always left-wing, communist-oriented guerrilla or liberation fighters around the world. But no general support of the World Council goes to liberation groups. That is, liberation grants that are given represent some 2% of the $85 million handled by the World Council each year. That is about $66 million of which goes for refugee care in relief and development efforts. So we're talking about a very small amount of money, and that special fund of PCR, the Program to Combat Racism, is noted for the churches, and special funds go into it, the churches knowing that this amount of money in that special fund will go for that purpose. So the general funds are not used. Let me pick one or two others, and one is a very big one, which we may tackle more in length on Thursday night, but I'll read the questions off one in a row. Is the Council Third World or Soviet dominated? And why have no grants been made to oppressed dissidents in the Soviet Union? And isn't criticism of the West greater than that of the Soviet bloc? The answer to the last one really answers all of them. The answer is yes, it is stronger. Criticism of the West is stronger, really, by the nature of freedom. The answer is not that there is greater evil in one place or another, but there's simply greater freedom to criticize in one instance and not the other. And there we could get into some details. Certainly in relating to the Soviet Union, some very powerful communications have occurred, and I think equally as strong interchanges between Geneva and Moscow, as have occurred probably more so than directly with the government or government offices of North American or North Atlantic capitalistic countries. So it's a matter of citing the difference and noting that some folks couldn't go back home again or may never return to an ecumenical involvement if certain things were done by a world church body. And those things have to do with the decisions such as that made on the Afghanistan situation. I'll let John talk about the question sometime as to whether or not the World Council is Marxist-leaning, which is a charge often made. Phil Potter has often quoted Karl Marx by saying that in order to change structures, new people are needed. He uses that quote very often. I think he does it purposely, because he sets himself up, and then the radio says, "Not Phil Potter, obviously leaning towards Marxism, because he quoted Karl Marx." He did it at our National Lutheran Church in America assembly or convention in Louisville last year. And he does it purposely to indicate that But there is still truth to a Marxist critique, and that doesn't mean that you're necessarily Marxist. Another charge is that the staff in Geneva is entrenched and hence able to dictate and carry forward these directions which are wrong and wrong-headed. I don't know of any organization in which 80% of the staff has changed since Nairobi, or say nothing of a corporation or even a local church office. So I think there's just it's just ill-founded a good bit of it. But let's stop with that and open it up. You can pick up many, many other concrete examples of criticism. I think it'd be the wrong place to place our emphasis tonight. So please, why don't we open it up and just go whatever direction you'd like to go in talking about this question of the criticism and negative evaluation of the ecumenical efforts and where it might be stemming from. So please, anyone.
Okay.
Please.
In 1975 at Nairobi, the delegates of my church, Lutheran Church in Brazil, asked, before starting the whole thing, asked that if possible the name Brazil would not be cited. Why? They were afraid. They asked that if possible, Brazil would not be mentioned. The name Brazil would not be mentioned. Why? Because we were coming out of a very harsh dictatorship and censorship with tortures, with people who disappeared and so forth. And everybody was not yet sure that this, by 75, this was just a little opening up. It was not as we have it today. Nobody was sure that if you would talk or criticize Brazil, that when coming back, you would not suffer consequences. The same happened when I talked about Ethiopia. People asked me, you're a Latin American, you can talk about Ethiopia. We cannot. These are actual situations. Now, something else. In our small groups meeting with Orthodox bishops, they said, you can look at history in the Eastern countries. Whenever something happened, the first to die, the first to be killed were the bishops. So many times we from the Western world think that these Eastern bishops, they are backward, they don't think care only about their spirituality, they're 200,000 years behind. No, they have a different kind of working with their faith than we have. But they do it also, and when necessary, they are as active as we are. About McIntyre, they had a picket saying, get the KGB out of the WCC. And I went to one of those guys and asked him, said, I have something to add. He said, what? And CIA. Oh, he blew to the room. And he said that he didn't leave. He said that I was lying, that I was not even a Brazilian, that I was a KGB agent, all this stuff. And I said, I don't care about KGB, neither CIA. I want to have my third Christian way out of this. I don't accept these two solutions that you people give me. And then talking to an American who in the small group, he said, you know, McIntyre is a wonderful thing for the WCC because he was there in Amsterdam. This means we are doing a good job. Now, he has a small organization. It's called the International Council of Christian Churches. And he has money. Question is, where does he get his money from? The racist people? The transnationals? I don't know.
That one. Please, go ahead.
Do you want to respond to something?
No, it had to do with maybe what you're going to say about sources of money.
Well, I have a theory about it, but I wasn't going to talk about it. I was just wanting to respond to a few of the things that you raised, but maybe we haven't finished those up.
No, that's all right.
Anybody want to react or comment on what Arno said? If not, please.
Yeah, just a few things. It seems to me that in your historical overview, one element that is sometimes not mentioned, but which is becoming increasingly important, I think, for understanding the whole ecumenical history, is the fact that one of the dominant groups that contributed towards the World Council of Churches was the Alliance for Peace through the Churches. I think that mm-hmm. that's the correct name. And that whole movement in the period between the two world wars seems to me to be very significant. that the World Council of Churches hasn't just suddenly become concerned about peace initiatives and aligning itself with peace movements, but that, Dietrich Bonhoeffer came into ecumenism through the Alliance of the Churches for Peace. So I think that's one thing that we need to just put on the agenda at some point. Then I think another area that needs to be worked at a bit is to identify the different types of opposition to the World Council. They range from the kind of thing we've been talking about on the sort of what we might call a lunatic fringe kind of thing, which is entertaining, through to a much more sophisticated theological critique, such as comes out from some of the evangelical groups who responsibly engage the World Council, and also from the Roman Catholic Church. And the Roman Catholic Church is not a member because they have certain differences at certain points. Now that isn't the same kind of opposition at all, but I think we need to tease out the different strands of opposition. It was interesting that the evangelicals at Vancouver dissociated themselves from others who were critical, and from other evangelicals such as Bauhaus and company. So I think we need to listen to some of the criticisms and not worry, waste our time with some of the others. And it might be helpful for people if the different types of opposition were set out. Then I think that we need to acknowledge, rather than simply brush over or reject the accusation of the Marxist orientation of the World Council in this respect. And I'm not suggesting that you were doing that, by the way, I'm just speaking out loud. But there is a great deal of social analysis within World Council thinking, as within the church as a whole in the Third World today and in other parts, that derives a great deal of insight from Marxian understandings of society and history. Mm. And that's very different from buying into the Marxist ideology in terms of a whole bunch of other things. And we need to separate those out and clearly acknowledge, yes, indeed, the church today benefits a great deal from sociological analysis, and sociological analysis without Karl Marx or any of the others is impossible. You can't do it. We that's part of the sociological heritage. And then the last observation I'd want to make would be with regard to the Afghanistan question and the Soviet hesitancy about us speaking on that issue and Brazil earlier and today Ethiopia. I think those of us coming from South Africa find that a very hard one to take. I'm not sure, but Desmond Tutu said to me just before I had to leave, the World Council reconvened on Wednesday night because it hadn't finished its agenda. One of the issues was Southern Africa. I'm not sure, was anybody there that night? Did Desmond get up and refer to Afghanistan?
Afghanistan was in the afternoon.
Yeah, no, but did Tutu. Did Desmond Tutu refer to it?
I wasn't in the whole time.
Oh, okay.
I think he did.
Desmond Tutu, as some of you may know, is a leading black bishop in South Africa and the forefront.
He spoke, yes, Wednesday night.
Night, right.
If you said Tutu, it's we Brazilians say Tutu. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Did he mention Afghanistan?
Yes.
His primary point, though, was that he wished something were in that statement saying that we also love the white people in South Africa.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was his primary point.
Right, okay. But the point that I'm going to make is that when the Afghanistan issue came up for discussion and the debate took place, I was talking to him, and he was very upset about this because he said, if the rationale is that we cannot speak about Afghanistan because of what will happen to some of the Russian delegates when they go back, how can we can criticize South Africa in the way that we have with a long document in the knowledge that some of us when we go back are going to be under considerable pressure and there will be action taken against us? Now there is a qualitative difference and we all acknowledge that. But it does raise this question, which I think needs exploration, and I fully understand the Russian one. I don't want to get into that now, but it does raise a question that we need to wrestle with, and that is, we need to develop a theological base for handling this issue in a consistent kind of way, mm-hmm. and put out on the table the rationale. Because I don't think that's been done. I think it's been sort of said or intimated, but not actually wrestled with as an ethical, a theological ethical issue. At what point does one speak, and at what point does one keep silent? Because I have a suspicion that sometimes we let churches off the hook, and that it's part of the ecumenical responsibility that we have to put churches in a position where they have to speak and become accountable. I think that's part of our responsibility. So I think that's an issue that I feel needs exploration.
All those observations, I think, are well taken. One of the most important bridges built in Vancouver, certainly that the bridge to a segment of the evangelical, new evangelical charismatic community, with the document that was presented to everybody and with a clear, positive affirmation of many developments of the assembly. But I think we should say one word about
how was that presentation? Most of us don't know about that. Was that just one of these handouts that they made, or?
It really didn't come before the assembly as a document, but it was presented officially to everybody and with the okay. I mean, it wasn't. It was done outside, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. I have a copy here.
Yeah, we've got.
They had a
copies.
Meeting of their own, mm-hmm. and in this meeting they made this document, mm-hmm. which I think was unexpected by the World Council of Churches.
The reason I raised the question, I was at the opening meeting and got quite a few of the handouts I was offered, not all of them, and I didn't see that.
No, this was at the end.
No, it came out.
I think Tuesday.
Monday at the end of the assembly.
I think it should be said, if I may, that there were two evangelical documents. Mm-hmm. The one from the Bauhaus group, which is very critical, and I think taking a lot of things out of context, and then this majority evangelical statement.
Simply untruthful.
Yeah, untruthful. Yeah. And it would be interesting to see which press picks up which document.
Just about guess. But I think part of that, too, is the fact that there is a new kind of set of alliances emerging among evangelical Christian communities, which may, in fact, begin to form another Christian world communion, for better or worse. And they are involved in the annual meetings of the secretaries of Christian world communions now, Lovelace and others. So there's the beginning of that kind of formation, such as there is also the United Churches around the world. But that raises also a question about your statement about criticism of the Roman Catholic Church. I have a hunch that the primary assumption in the Vatican is that they would never join the World Council of Churches, simply because it would sink the ship.
Sure.
Structurally, it would sink the ship. And I think Willebrands has said that privately a couple of times. But they also already are a universal church, a Catholic church. And I've heard a number of them say we are committed to the ecumenical movement and have been since 1965, Second Vatican Council. We are pursuing it on lots of fronts, including a structural relationship with the World Council, the only world communion which has a joint working group, as well as 12 members on the Faith and Order Commission, which developed the Eucharist statement, Baptism, Eucharist, Ministry statement. But I think they also have in mind that there will be an evolution of ecumenical structures, and at some point there will be a restructuring of the movement, 100 years, 20, who knows. And if that were to happen, there would then be more of a possibility that the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic and however else you might have representation present in such an ecumenical forum, they would feel much more comfortable and see that to be more likely. That's not said so much out in the open, but certainly it's talked about.
Can I just respond, just very quickly? I'm not thinking here about Roman Catholic opposition in the Vatican or in the Secretariat for, ecumenism. I'm thinking here of, these other groups are fringe groups. I'm thinking of opposition within the Catholic tradition to this kind of ecumenism. I think that's the thing that I was.
And that we would all have in our traditions,
okay.
Not to that scope.
Sure.
Someone else want to say something? Please.
I'm from a very Roman Catholic country. 93%, 92 to 93% of Brazilians are baptized as Roman Catholics, and one has to consider this. We would like them to be more open ecumenically. But one has to consider that it is not even 20 years since that Second Vatican closed. So they really ran centuries in these 18 years. When the Roman, when the representative of the Vatican spoke after the document about the relations with the Roman Catholic Church was read, there were some people doing things in our Brazilian delegation, and I didn't get the whole thing, but it seems to me that he announced that the Pope would visit Geneva next year, isn't it?
Yes. It was planned in 1981, right before the assassination attempt occurred, and had to be canceled. So it's just a reschedule.
But this means a lot, because we have to consider that John Paul II is a Polish Roman Catholic, which even within the Roman Catholic Church is a very special, traditional-minded and conservative church within the whole Roman Catholic Church.
That's a whole other topic to talk internal Catholic politics, but certainly we should support our friends in the Unity Secretariat as best we can, given what's happening in Rome now.
I was just going to ask, I understood that it was sort of a call for some kind of ethical, theological stance that would be, that you could point to like this, right? And I was going to ask, I don't know if you'd be the one to ask, is there a forum, is there a place, are there plans for something like that to be worked out or worked through? Or is it still just, yes, we should do this, it would be nice, and then it takes, you know, another...
Well, this could come up later, Janet, in terms of impressions, but as one involved in trying to monitor that, along with a bunch of other faculty at Vancouver School of Theology, we tracked one development in the assembly that I'm convinced is the most important development of Vancouver, even though it's not talked about that much. And it gets, I'll try not to get too complex with this, because it has a very serious history. And it is an attempt to take the concept of conciliarity, which is the model of unity that the World Council has developed the last 10, 15 years, conciliar fellowship as a model of unity, and link that unity concept to a process of concrete confessing. And that occurred first in pre-assembly documents from a group from Germany. Some work here at Holden was done in relationship to that group. And it builds on the German confessing church idea, when the church said, no, it's wrong for the Third Reich to take control of our clergy. So there was a clearly defined persecuted group and a confessing church posture taken in relationship to a view of the church. So the connection there would be that that a process may now be possible in the World Council, whereby the conciliarity idea and concept, which is about all it's been so far, can be linked to quite concrete ethical decisions.
Could I make a point on that?
Yeah.
I'll try and elaborate a bit tomorrow morning. I think the key thing here is the confession of the faith is not simply a dogmatic or verbal confession. Of course, we have our exploration of our apostolic tradition and so on, Orthodox, Protestant, and hopefully Roman Catholics altogether. But the key thing about confession, as with the confessing church, is it is word and deed. Right. And that's where the ethics come in.
And I think,
because we can't fail to practice what we preach.
Yeah.
If we do, we lose our credibility.
So you're actually saying then that what he's calling for is actually being acted out. It's just
I'm saying that this is becoming the absolute nub of many of our ecumenical difficulties and disputes. It's not disputes over dogmatic issues, Baptist and Eucharist and ministry, that are dividing us. It's our inconsistency over practicing what we preach. It's our inconsistency over stands for social justice. It's our failure to be a church alongside the poor. It's some of these issues that today are the most deeply divisive issues, both within our confessions and between our confessions. It's this that's splitting open some of the national and local situations, as well as making very difficult further progress at the international level. But I think this is a price we have to pay. We can't just cruise along kidding ourselves that we're achieving ecumenical fellowship around the world, around the table of our Lord, if we are denying by our actions what we are expressing in our lives of worship together and so on.
John wanted to come in.
Yeah, I was sort of beginning to realize I'm talking too much. I do want to pick this one up at some point.
That's a problem of the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, two concrete examples of this should maybe, somebody else want to come?
I was saying, no, that's not a geographical place.
But there were two events which were very important that didn't happen in local history as much as in here or in Canada, Ottawa in last summer in 1977 in Dar es Salaam, where One World Communion in Dar es Salaam, it happened to be the Lutherans, said that our understanding of the church as a place where the communion is celebrated and sisters and brothers should come to worship, basic to our definition of a church as Lutherans, is being violated by the policy of apartheid in South Africa. Hence, they raised that issue to the level they called it status confessionis, which means Article 7 of our Augsburg Confession, says that when the sisters and brothers, black and white, cannot come to the Eucharist together, it's a church matter. It violates our fundamental understanding of the church. That was one precedent. And the World Alliance in Canada last summer gathered, and the black members, black representative, or black church representative, I understand, refused to go to the communion. Some percent, whatever. Refused to commune at the opening worship service. Were you there?
No.
I guess it was a very anguishing process. But it raised the issue right away, and many other people said, no, we will not commune either if they don't. And their argument was, if we can't commune blacks and whites in South Africa, how dare we do it here in Canada? And as a result, they had to deal with it. The result was the expulsion of a number of white member churches from the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. Would you care to qualify that? I was not in Ottawa. They're no longer
members. Well, I'll give a commercial first. Part It Is a Heresy, published by Erdmans, edited by John DeGruchy next month, explores all these issues. But this is, I was going to not say that, but now that you mentioned it. I'll be dealing with the status confessionis and the confessing church in South Africa during the course of the week and look at this whole debate, so I don't want to talk about it now. I just wanted to pick up a missing of each other, because the theological ethical issue that I was raising is not the one that we've been discussing, but it is related to it. And it's related to the status confessionis in this way. Let me give you a concrete example. At the time of the confessing church in Germany, there was a struggle going on within the ecumenical movement as to which church do we recognize in Germany. Do we recognize the church, the state church in Germany as constituted under the Reichsbishop, or do we recognize the confessing church as led by people like Niemöller and Karl Barth and a few others? And there was real consternation within the World Council, within the ecumenical movement, because they didn't know which group to recognize. The confessing church wanted them to recognize the confessing church and to exclude the state church. It's very complex, but that's sort of a simplistic interpretation. And of course, the state church wanted to be recognized as the in continuity with the church in Germany since the Reformation. The ecumenical movement prevaricated. They really didn't come down clearly enough, and that led to a great deal of disillusionment within the circles around Dietrich Bonhoeffer and others. But the confessing church was on the agenda. The idea of status confessionis after centuries was back into the ecumenical debate. It has now returned since Dar es Salaam in 1977 and Ottawa last year and the debates in South Africa and in West Germany. But it does raise the question of where is the true church in a particular situation? Where is the church, in fact, confessing Christ as Lord, is the question. Now, this raises a particular problem for the dealing, the ecumenical relations between churches of the Reformed and Lutheran traditions and, let's say, the Russian Orthodox. Because the Russian Orthodox don't have that concept at all. There's an organic understanding of the church as an organism that has evolved through history, and the true church is where the hierarchy and the liturgy and the dogma are in continuity with the early councils of the church. And that holds the thing together. If we had to raise the question of a confessing church in Russia, it would split the thing wide open as to where is the true church. But this is the question that I'm raising in terms of the theological ethical question. Because it is the pressing question that churches in a persecuted kind of situation are raising. In other words, at what point, for example, and I talked this through at great length with a Russian Orthodox theologian up to Vancouver, and I think I understand the whole problem, but at what point would the World Council of Churches be at liberty, if it was necessary at any stage, to say to the Russian Orthodox Church, you are no longer confessing Christ as Lord in that situation? If we build into our negotiations at this point that we cannot say anything about the Russian situation, that is the ethical, theological problem.
I don't think you're altogether fair. I don't think that this double standard argument, we can't elaborate it now, is altogether truthful. We have different strategies vis-a-vis different churches. It's for pastoral reasons, for pedagogical reasons.
I know the whole thing,
But the Russian Orthodox Church, in fact, is a very good example of a church that has taken, almost as to the level of status confessionis, the question of a commitment to peace. The Russian Orthodox Church has run a long way, almost to the embarrassment and irritation of its own government at times, in declaring a commitment to peace and disarmament. And that, for them, is becoming a touchstone of the faith.
Yes.
And this is being echoed in a whole number of other Eastern countries.
I think you're missing my point, because I'm not actually... I understand, and I think it's important to clear the record.
Yeah.
I'm not criticising the Russian Orthodox Church at this point at all. I'm using it as an illustration of the theological, ethical problem of accountability.
Yeah.
And we've got to clarify that one so that we know when it is time to be quiet and when it is time to criticize. That's the issue.
The reason I asked for a clarification of your statement is because I felt like what you were asking for is almost an impossible task, and there's only something that could be continually done in process.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think they're all done in process.
It's a nice ideal and a goal to continually
I was relieved that we didn't push at this assembly to make a status confessionis. It would have blown the assembly apart for the reasons you indicated.
Sure.
And I was relieved when they used the idea of lodging a process of confessing in consultation with each other as a linkage between doctrine and concrete ethical determining, a very key development. Yeah. If it goes well, the bell has rung and we've just started here.
Yeah.
But anybody else have a final word they want to say on this thing? We'll stop then and pursue this in other settings.
We've all been trained to bells too well.
Yeah, I know.